Hey, folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Jillian Richardson.
And he just looks at me and says, I would like to be your slave. I'm like, okay.
That and more. But before that, I just want to say, hey, we are having so much fun with our Patreon patrons. If you don't know, you can help to keep Risk running. If you go to patreon.com/risk and become one of our patrons, could be as little as $1 a month, $5 a month, whatever you can give. There are all kinds of amazing perks and prizes. We just made a music video for our fans that we posted there. I do little diaries. I record things. I take photos and have behind the scenes stuff that patrons can check out there on the site. And there's all kinds of like prizes for particular amounts that you can give. So you can check all that out at patreon.com/risk. We super really desperately need for our fans to be showing support for the show financially. And that is an easy and fun way to do it. Patreon.com/risk. Also, you can maximize every minute and every dollar for your small business with Stamps.com. You don't have to waste any time going to the post office. Stamps.com is a better way to get postage. Just use what you already have, your computer and printer, to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package, and then the mailman picks it up. With Stamps.com, everything you do at the post office, you can do from your own desk and at a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. We use Stamps.com at Risk and the Story Studio, and we love it. And right now you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our offer code RISK for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in RISK. That's Stamps.com. Enter RISK. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. Now here's the show. Hello, kids, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is the Go Team behind me now. We're calling this week's episode Getting to Know You. These are three stories about sexual or romantic relationships that got really interesting really quickly. We're going to hear in a little bit from Jillian Richardson, who is a freelance writer here in New York City. She was a fan of the show, and she pitched us this fantastic story a while back. So we had her do it at the Bell House in Brooklyn, where we do our show once a month. But before that, we're going to hear a story from our Montreal show that we did, sometime in 2016. I can't remember when, but it was a really, really fun, sweet show in Montreal. And this fella, Jeff Gandel, pitched us a bunch of stories that was very, very interesting. It's a very brand new little storytelling scene that's popping up there in Montreal, so we hope to come back soon. Anyway, here he is now. This is Jeff Gandel, who you can also find on Twitter, at Jeff Gandel, with a story we call Wart and All.
It's So about 12 years ago, I'm an English as a second language teacher, and I give lessons in my apartment. And one day this woman comes in, this Peruvian woman named Angela, and she's just a vision. She's got dark skin and dark curly hair, and she's wearing a bandana, and she has crooked teeth, something I've always found irresistible in women. And I'm immediately smitten with her. And she starts taking lessons, and as the weeks go on, I become more and more attracted to her. And one day, in a fit of courage, I ask her out. And she says yes. And we start going out, and we start dating, and we fall in love. And it's just this beautiful, magical summer romance. And I'm so happy, and I'm certain I've never met anyone that I've loved more, or a situation that's more perfect for me. And a few weeks into our relationship, we're planning to go away for the weekend. And the night before we're planning to go away, I have a friend's bachelor party. So I go to my friend's bachelor party, and I want to be a good boyfriend, and I want to be in good shape for when we go away the next day, so I don't drink very much, and there's drugs there, and I don't do any drugs, and I want to make sure that I'm a good boyfriend and that I'm responsible. I still stay up all night because it's a friend's bachelor party, and I have a commitment to my friend to at least help him have a good time on this evening. So I get home early in the morning, and I want to get a couple of hours sleep before it's time for Angela and I to go away for the weekend. And she calls me early in the morning, and she can tell that I'm exhausted. I'm really tired. And she says to me, you know, if you're really tired, you can sleep and we can go away another weekend. And I'm like, thank you. Yes, can we please do that? That would be amazing. I'm just too tired to drive anywhere. And I'm thinking, not only am I the perfect boyfriend, but she's the perfect girlfriend. She really gets me. We have this symbiotic relationship where we just work together and she fully understands me, and it's wonderful. So I have a peaceful sleep. I wake up and I call her later in the day, and she says, I don't want to talk to you, and hangs up the phone. And I'm like, fuck. You know, she seemed so cool with it. And so I call her back a few times, and she keeps hanging up on me. And I can't take it, because when people are upset with me, I feel like it's always my fault. It's 100% my fault. And this enormous sense of guilt comes over me. So I have to take care of this situation right away. So I hop in my car and I drive to her house, and I see her on the way on her bike. And I put my window down and I say, Angela, and she ignores me. She's like, I'm not even there. And this is like the most painful moment of my life. It's like this woman that I'm in love with is completely ignoring me, and I'm yelling her name and she just bikes away. So she ignores me for 2 days, and I'm in just a state of total agitation, because I'm sure that I've done something to fuck up this relationship. It's all my fault. I take it all on myself. This goes on for a couple days, and then we make up, and you know, things continue, things get more intense. But as the relationship goes on, she starts to get angrier and angrier about things that I do, where it gets to the point where about once every 2 weeks, she explodes in a fit of rage over something I'd done. And her anger was really getting to be a little bit too much for me. And one day I tried to break up with her, and I went to her house, and I tried to break up with her, and she was yelling, and I couldn't take it, so I ran out of her house, and she was following me. And I'm walking back to my apartment, and I had told her previously that like my dad used to yell at me when I was a kid, and it scared me. So she was like up in my face saying like, Do I scare you like your father used to scare you? And I'm like, no, this is much scarier than anything my father ever did. And she's just like following me, and I go back to my apartment, and I don't want to let her in my apartment because I'm afraid of her. So I circle around the block a few times, and she's just like following me and in my face, like, do I scare you? I'm like, yes, what more do you want me to say? But I can't get rid of her, so I go into my apartment, and she muscles her way into my apartment, and we're still arguing, and she pours a glass of orange juice over my head. It's a big mess. So this is the kind of madness that our relationship had descended into. Around the same time, I had a giant plantar wart at the bottom of my foot. And I would go to the dermatologist once every 2 weeks, where he would spray the wart with liquid nitrogen. And has anyone ever had liquid nitrogen treatments on a wart? I guess you don't want to admit it. Don't yell it. Never mind. The person next to you doesn't want to know. But the way it works is like it doesn't hurt at first, like the first treatment, because warts are kind of, they have a tough exterior. But as it gets deeper and deeper into the wart, as the treatments go on, it starts to hurt more and more until it's like this excruciating, stinging pain that lasts for like a few hours after each treatment. So my life at the time was punctuated by this bi-weekly emotional pain where Angela would just yell at me and get angry at me, and this bi-weekly physical pain where the dermatologist would spray my foot with liquid nitrogen. And for me, you know, I kind of thought that the wart was some kind of physical manifestation of how shitty a person I was, that I was doing something to make Angela angry, so this was being paid back on me with the wart on my foot. And they had appeared, like our first fight and the wart had appeared at around the same time. So it was very clear what I had to do. I had to break up with Angela. I had to get out of this relationship. And there was also some kind of belief that if I broke up with Angela, the wart would disappear also. this is the way my mind works. So I plan to break up with her. I invited her over to my apartment, which is obviously the worst place to break up with somebody, because you can't leave. So I invited her over to my apartment, and I poured her a nice glass of orange, raspberry, and passion fruit juice, and I started to do it like as passively and as softly as I can. And I'm like, you know, Angela, I'm not really happy. She's like, you know, why are you not happy? And I'm like, well, you know, we fight all the time. And she's like, yeah, we do, but we, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in our relationship too. And I'm like, wouldn't you be happier if we weren't together? You know, the most passive way you can break up with someone. No, I wouldn't be happier if we weren't together. So this goes on for like an hour, this back and forth where we're not getting anywhere and I'm losing ground. So I figure I need to take it to a new level. So I look her in the eyes and I say, Angela, I'm not in love with you anymore. Well, that does it, because she grabs some CDs from the rack next to her and starts throwing them against the wall. And then she takes her glass of juice and launches it across the room where it shatters against the left speaker, splattering glass and juice everywhere. And why the fuck do I keep giving her juice? I feel like juice is some kind of soothing drink to give to people when they're upset. Like, it's part of my Jewish nature to make people feel calm at all moments. And then she starts punching and kicking me, and she's small, but her anger makes her strong, and I'm batting away her fists and her legs, and I don't want to hit her back, but I don't know what to do, so I say, get the fuck out of here. Which is bad, because I wanted like a perfect, beautiful breakup, and then one of the last things I'm going to say to her is, get the fuck out of here. And she runs to the table in the hall and grabs the keys, and then runs to my bedroom and belly flops down on the bed with my keys trapped underneath her, and I'm trying to wrestle them away from her, and I can't get them away from her, and finally I'm just like, Angela, we need to get out of here. Like, let's go to a cafe and talk. We just need to leave the apartment. As soon as we're outside and I lock the door, I run. I just bolt. I run away, and it's a snowstorm, and I pull away in my car in the snowstorm with her, like, chasing me like a film. And I go to my friend's house, and I'm in a state. I'm like, shaking, and I'm all fucked up. And my friends are like, my friend and his girlfriend, they're like, you know, if she's hitting you, probably made the right choice in breaking up with her. And that makes me feel better. And then the next morning, I find little torn pieces of photographs of us embedded in the snow all over my car. Breakup confetti. And that makes me feel even better that I've made the right choice. And I'm certain that with Angela out of my life, the wart will disappear, and my body will return to its pristine state of youthful perfection. Which is not what happens. About 3 weeks after breaking up with Angela, I slip on some ice snowboarding at J Peak and my thumb bends backwards. I know there's a problem when I can't roll a joint on the car ride home. After a 14-hour emergency room visit, I leave the Montreal General with a broken thumb and a honking cast on my arm. About 4 weeks after breaking up with Angela, I get my 3 front teeth replaced with fake ones. I knew I'd had to get one of them replaced because it had no root, a result of a previous medical condition, and the dentist said he would have to do a little filing of the 2 healthy teeth next to the problem one. And after he did the little filing and went to fetch the temporary bridge, I saw that what he meant by a little filing was shaving the healthy teeth down to little nubs to serve as anchors for the bridge. I rubbed my tongue on them and they were like sharp little chiclets. They weren't teeth anymore. I looked in the mirror. I looked like an old man without his dentures. I stood in front of the mirror that night and I looked at the bridge. It wasn't the right size. It was a temporary bridge. It wasn't the permanent one, but it wasn't the right size. And it was 27 and I had fake buck teeth. My cast itched. And the bottom of my foot burned from the previous day's nitrogen blast. The things couldn't get any worse. And that's when Angela calls. I'm coming to pick up my bike, she says, and slams the phone down. I'm terrified. There's no way that I could face her in my state. What if she punches me in my bridge? It was very expensive. What if she breaks my cast? It's 14 hours in the emergency room, so I don't know what to do. And then I get an idea, so I take her bike and I leave it in the lobby of my building along with a note saying I'd had to run out. I was very proud of this plan. There was a chance someone might steal it, but that was a chance I was willing to take. And then I go in my bedroom and I go in my apartment. I turn off all the lights and I sit in the middle of the living room, far away from the windows with the lights off, just terrified of moving. And so about an hour later, the buzzer from downstairs starts buzzing, and it doesn't stop. And I'm like, shit, she didn't buy my ruse that I wasn't home. And she just, it's like a constant buzz for like half an hour, and I'm just sitting in the apartment, terrified to move. I called my friend. I think my friend found it funny. I was scared. And so I'm just sitting there, like, this buzzing is invading my brain. And then finally it stops, and I wait a few minutes, and then I crawl over to the window, and I look outside, and there's Angela in the middle of the street, just looking up at my window, and our eyes meet. Busted. So I have to go downstairs to face her, and my heart's pounding, and I go downstairs in the lobby, and she's like, somebody could have stolen my bike. I'm like, I'm afraid of you. I just spent 14 hours in the emergency room. And sure enough, she comes up to me and starts hitting me in the chest. And I just run outside, and I run down the street and around the corner and into the police station. What am I doing in the police station? I'm shaking and I'm numb and I can't speak. And I say to the policewoman behind the counter, my ex-girlfriend is hitting me. The policewoman's sitting back in her chair with her feet up on her desk, bored. Like, this happens 10 times a night. And she's like, do you want to press charges? No, I don't want to press charges. Well, there's nothing we can do. Okay. Thanks, police. So I leave the police station and I go back to my apartment, and Angela's there. And when I tell her where I've been, she's like, I can't get arrested. I'm applying for my citizenship. Well, don't go around hitting people. And she starts crying, and I say, look, let's just go for a coffee and talk about it. That coffee I said we would go for, that we never did. So we go to the cafe, and things calm down in the cafe, and I apologize for the way things ended. And she asked me what happened to my thumb, and she tells me she started swing dancing, and we even manage a few laughs. I'd like to sleep over, she says. She starts crying and telling me how much she misses me and how much she wants to sleep in my arms. Now, you'd think this would be an easy decision. I was just cowering in fear of her in my apartment, but I was tempted. And, you know, her face was puffy from the tears, and she was a mess, and she was wearing a sweater vest with orange track pants. But she was cute, and I was still attracted to her. And besides that, when we'd been together, I'd been as attracted to the madness and the emotional abuse as her laugh or her smile. You know, we like to divide relationships into good and bad parts, but it's all part of the same package. And when you're in love, you're obsessed with all the parts of your relationship and the person. But I also felt in that moment that it wasn't all my fault. You know, I had been blaming myself entirely for everything that was happening, but I wasn't responsible for the way she felt, and the relationship, I was at most 50% responsible, maybe less. And so I kind of forgave myself a little, and I said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. In the weeks that followed, or the months that followed, my thumb healed, and I got my permanent bridge, and it looked good. It looked better than my original teeth. The wart went away. Came back, went away, came back. Finally, it went away for good. And my dermatologist praised my tenacity in sticking out the treatments. He said, most people just let their warts go on forever. I thought that was an apropos metaphor for my relationship with Angela. But once I realized that it's not all my fault and I can't be responsible for how other people feel, and there was two people in this relationship, not just me. Once I forgave myself, the wart went away, and it never came back. Thank you.
Jean had warts.
Oh, it was disgusting. It was gross. It just was gross. But on your hand, especially right in the middle of your hand, it's like very...
Unpleasant.
I've got you.
This whole goddamn thing's been a big pain in the ass.
Under my skin.
Now look, there's no need to panic.
Gross.
Oh, God, that was awful. Oh, that's disgusting.
I told you so.
It isn't as bad as it looks.
There's nothing to be ashamed of.
What the fuck?
So who here had a brother or sister who was older than them and way cooler than they were? Yeah, so that was me. My sister was the kind of person, she was 6 years older. She was the star of the varsity volleyball team. She dated a Calvin Klein underwear model. And she was the kind of person when she walked by a guy, one time he was in a golf cart and was just looking at her and crashed into a tree. So meanwhile, there's 10-year-old me. I'm in the school chamber choir. We have this outfit that's like one of those ruffly white shirts that are not flattering at all. A blue cummerbund, blue bow tie. I do Harry Potter role playing with my friends. We're just really different people. I just feel like I can't compare to the coolness that is my sister. I get my first kiss when I'm 16 to a guy who is he's obsessed with dirt biking. His name is George Stern. He ignored me in driver's ed. I lost my virginity at 19 to a guy who I thought was really cool. And then the next week, he invited me to a party and was making out with another girl when I got there. So by the time I was 20 years old, I had no confidence in myself in relation to men. I thought that I wasn't going to be able to have a good relationship with a guy. So when I'm 20 years old, I am interning in New York City. It's really a place where, you know, people say anything could happen, but I was spending most of my nights at Columbia University just sitting on my laptop and just browsing through the internet. One day, I'm watching a documentary called Hotline, which is about people whose job it is to be a hotline and they talk to strangers. And there are people who were psychics or who worked for crisis hotlines, and there was one about sex workers who worked for hotlines. And this I thought was very interesting. And one of the sex workers mentioned that she got most of her clients through FetLife. For those of you who don't know, FetLife is a website that's like Facebook for people who have kinks. And I was just really curious. I was like, I want to go on this website and like check this out. So I made kind of a shell account just to see what it was like, you know, just to look around. Like I wasn't going to do anything, of course. But I started to notice, I was just going through people's profiles and saw things that I really liked and started adding it to my own profile. So slowly I start to build a profile. Then I notice there's an events tab and it has things that cool kinky people do in New York City. And I was like, maybe I'll do something like that, maybe in the future. And that's how I end up in a sex dungeon. I am there, I am standing in front of an entire class and I am learning how to paddle a man. And it's me, and the demographics of this class is totally different than I thought it would be. I thought it would be a lot of people who were new at this and didn't really know what they were doing. Turns out it was me and a bunch of professional dominatrixes who were just there to kind of up their skills, just learn some new stuff for fun, and then it's me, and somehow I end up in the front of the room learning how to do all these things because the teacher thinks it's cute because I'm absolutely terrified. At one point in the class, the teacher says, all right, it's time for us to work one-on-one. She gives us a script, and she just goes, all right, grab your slaves. And there's a bunch of men, by the way, in the back of this room who are there as volunteer slaves, which to me was very new. It's like, okay, cool. I'm still processing that you just said the phrase volunteer slaves. But of course, all these women are pros, so they are ready. They do not give a fuck. They see someone who they like. There's like this one guy who's really hot. He's a surgeon. They see him and they grab him. And all the guys are taken except for one. And that's who I end up with. He looks like he maybe could have been my cab driver on the way over there. He's in his 60s. He's Eastern European. He's kind of chubby. And he really doesn't speak English. I'm like, how did this guy end up in this class? It's like a very specific place for you to be. So this is my partner for... I'm in the sex dungeon for 4 hours. I'm learning. how to do everything to this guy. I am freaking out inside the whole time. I'm losing my mind. On the outside, thank God this teacher gave me a script of things to say, so I'm just looking at it. I'm just trying to use my like soft, threatening voice, telling him to look at the floor so I don't have to make eye contact with him because I'm panicking. And I'm in there for 4 hours. By the time the class is over, I leave. I just get out of there. I'm standing on the sidewalk, and I cannot believe I was just in a sex dungeon for 4 hours. And I'm just like, oh, I don't know. I guess I like go get falafel now. Like, what do I do? And I'm just looking at my phone, and someone taps me on the shoulder and says, goddess? I don't even realize this person could even possibly be talking to me, so I just keep looking at my phone, and they tap me again on the shoulder, just, goddess? I'm like, oh, that's me. This person's talking to me. Right, of course, yes, domly, I'm a dominant woman. Yes, this person's talking to me. And I turn around, and it's the surgeon from the class who everyone was so excited to have as their slave. I'm just like, hey. And he tells me that he was really into the way that I presented myself in the class, and he thought I was really beautiful. And he just looks at me and says, I would like to be your slave. I'm like, okay. I'm so bad at being dominant just on the streets of New York City. I'm like, we could, no, I mean, like, what, do you want to do that? We're like, oh no, I shouldn't be asking you if you want to do that because this is about what I want, right? Okay. And I'm honest with him, and I tell him that I've not really done this before. I don't really know what I want, so I get this guy's number. I take a few days to think about it, and I decide that yeah, I want to do this. I want to try this out. So I'm staying at a dorm at Columbia University, as I said. So I tell this guy to come all the way uptown to Columbia University to give me a foot massage, because that's one thing in the class that we did that I really loved. And I was like, I can do this like all day. This is easy. And he's into it. And so he meets me in front of the library at Columbia University. And I'm like, oh God, like again, we're in public. Like, what is the power dynamic here? Like, I don't want to be mean to this person when there's other people around, like, unless that's what he wants, but I have no idea. So we're just here for this like domination thing. I'm just like, how was your subway ride? How's your CrossFit class going? What's up with you? And he seems like kind of off put that I'm not acting all dominating like I was in the class. I tell him again that I'm nervous. We walk all the way across the campus, and then we get to the security guard who's guarding my dorm. And we both have to give our IDs to the security guard, who takes a little bit longer than usual to look at the IDs because this guy is like 15 years older than I am. The security guard's just like, what the hell is going on here? But he just looks and I'm like waiting for him to say something, and he just goes, you kids have fun. Cool. So we finally get into my dorm room, and from here I like actually have a plan. Like, this is what I knew what we were gonna do. But I'm still really nervous, so I'm trying to think in my head, like, okay, what did we do in the class that was good? So I have him stand in the corner, just stand there, and I say that he does not yet have the gift of looking at me. That is one of my favorite parts from the class. I'm like, you don't have the gift of looking at me, because I am a gift, and you do not deserve it yet. oh, man. But really, I'm just, like, taking this time to just breathe deeply and just, like, not be panicking this whole time, because I'm like, oh, my God. I'm just like, there's a man in my room standing in the corner, and he's doing it. Like, I told him to stand in the corner, and he's doing it. So this is intense. And finally, I'm like, okay. And he's a CrossFit guy. He's really good looking. He's, like, cut. And so the first thing I do is I just have him take off his shirt so I can literally just like look at him and just like run my hands over his body and just super objectify him, which to me is like amazing because as a woman that happens to us all the time, but without our consent, it just happens constantly. So for me to just be like checking out this guy and like making him kind of uncomfortable, but he's into it, I'm into it. And then I say, all right, it's like time for the foot massage part. So what I do is I sit on my bed. You can all do this at home if you want. Very easy. And you just have them sit on the ground. You wrap your legs around their necks. So you're like kind of choking them, but like not too much. And I ask him, what have you, and this is good because I didn't have to look directly in his eyes. I could just, he was sitting down there and I'm up here. And I ask him, what have you done for your goddess this week? And he tells me that instead of going to his CrossFit classes, which were very important to him, he skipped it and paid for a class to learn how to do massage instead. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, this is so good. But again, I'm like, no, don't act happy. Like, this happens to you all the time. And so I tell him that's good. And he starts to massage my feet and my calves. And he's like getting really into it. And I'm starting to get more into this dominant persona now that we're actually there. And I'm telling him that I own him now, and it's awesome. And then at some point, he's starting to get really into it, and he asks me to take off my clothes. And this kind of goes one against the dynamic. And I'm a little tempted to do it, because to be honest, in the past, I've had relationships with men where I go farther with them than I would want to sexually, just because I like them and I want the thing to keep going, so I just do it. And I was like, wait, no, like, what are you thinking? This is, you're dominant in this situation. You can do whatever the fuck you want. And so I tell him, no, like, you're just going to massage me. That's all this is going to be. You're not getting off. This is not for you. This is for me. And it was amazing to say that. And just to have that power dynamic totally switched with a man. And I tell him, like, you're going to finish this massage and you're going to get out of here. And you're not going to look at me because, again, I'm a gift. And you get to look at me as a gift. And also, before he's about to leave, I also add, and now on, when you're going to masturbate, you're going to have to ask me for I can't even say it now. You're going to have to ask me for permission first. And I was just like, no one told me to say that. That just came out of my own mouth. I just said it. After that point, I was just like, you know what? I'm going to use this summer to keep on exploring myself sexually. And I was in New York. I decided to take full advantage. So I was going to sex clubs. I was meeting all these people who were into so many different things. Like, I saw fire play and like wax play and people using electricity, like people who were sissies, people who were mermaids, people who dressed up like cats. And it was just so interesting to be in this world where I was constantly pushing my boundaries. And I noticed that in my regular dating life, or like my vanilla dating life, I had more people than ever asking me out. It's like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I'm getting more confident. And the things that had happened to my sister started happening to me. I had people spending $400 on dinner for me, and I had people asking me to go to the Hamptons. And it was really cool, but for some reason, I honestly didn't feel that happy with it. And I thought about why I liked women who were dominatrixes. And I realized that the reason that I liked them is because they didn't give a shit what other people thought about them. They didn't need other people to validate them. They just loved themselves as they are. I realized that I had made that transformation when a guy asked me to go to the Hamptons with him, and I didn't even care. I was like, why? Like, I don't even want to do that. But before this whole experience, I would have been thrilled. In the class that I took, the dominatrix class, the woman promised that we would find what she called our inner pussy power. That's what she had said. And so really, when I had a guy spend $400 on dinner on me and then asked me to go home to sleep with him, I felt totally confident saying no. And that's when I knew that I had found my own pussy power. Thank you.
When all around you there are lies, just to get you spies, just to get you to buy so they can get you. There are cameras in the sky, lasers in our living rooms. There are wolves watching wearing sheep's costumes. It's enough to make you go crazy. It's enough to make you mad. And
This is Risk. This is Brett Denon behind me now. I just created a Spotify playlist called The Best of Risk Music. If you look it up on Spotify, just look up The Best of Risk Music. It's curated by Kevin Allison. And in the process, I heard some of these great songs, our favorite songs we've featured on the show, and I decided to revisit some of those artists and see what they've done since then. So this is a nice little new Brett Denon song that I discovered in that process. Now, we just heard from Jillian Richardson, who you can find on Twitter at ThatJillian. And before that, we heard an interstitial by our fabulous episode editor, Mr. Jeff Barr. That was called Wart the Fuck. Now, I want to talk to you guys about Blue Apron. I'm sure you've already heard about Blue Apron. They are one of the creme de la creme of the hip, popular, new startups of the past several years. It's because it's such a great idea. They make it easy to make incredible home cooking. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow seasonal recipes of really delicious gourmet meals. You don't have to overspend at restaurants anymore or go to, you know, grocery stores looking for this, that, and the other. Blue Apron has partnered with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States to ensure their ingredients are of the highest quality. And because they ship the exact amount, you're not going to be wasting food, right? Some of the meals available in March include salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli, pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple, vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips, spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. I mean, come on! Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/risk. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/risk. Blue Apron is a better way to cook. Now, our last story today, this is a really strange situation. This fella, Lawrence Myers, is a writer. He contacted us. He was a fan of Risk. He contacted us and saw that we were going to have the great comedian Andy Kindler on the show out there in Los Angeles. And he said, I have a story about looking a lot like Andy Kindler, about people mistaking him for Andy Kindler. So we had this night in Los Angeles where both Andy and his lookalike shared stories. Now, here's the thing. Andy, like I said, is one of the funniest motherfuckers in the world. But the man, his brain goes 90 miles an hour from hilarious thought to random other hilarious thought. It's hard to get a fucking story out of Andy. So we don't have an Andy story to share with you. But we do have this story told an evening that Andy did show up at the Risk show and shared something. All right. So anyway, this is Lawrence Myers, and his story will explain itself. This is live in Los Angeles. We do the show there once a month at the Bootleg Theater. It's Lawrence Myers with a story we call Lookalike.
So, how many people here have come across their evil twin? Okay, I don't have an evil twin, and that's because I am the evil twin. This story was started in 1912, yeah, actually. I'm 200 years old. 2012, and it was 3 years after my divorce. And the first 18 months after it, you know, business was booming, so to speak, and then the next 18 month was dry as a bone. There's no sex to be had anywhere. And this was frustrating to me because I'm a fixer. I'm a fixer by personality, by occupation. As Beowulf mentioned, I fix things. People and companies come to me when they're being attacked from the outside. and I make those problems go away. I introduce risk into the equation, as I say. So this was very frustrating to me as a fixer, as a problem solver, this no sex 18-month thing and 18% response rate on OkCupid, not that I was keeping track, was down to 2%. And this was spilling over into the real world. And in the real world, I like people. I am good with people. There was no mojo. It was not happening. It was replaced by the kind of self-consciousness and doubt that I experienced in high school, which... you know what I'm talking about. And that voice, that inner voice, which likes to come up at those times and start saying things like, your hair looks fucking stupid. And your ass does look fat in those jeans. And turtlenecks went out in the 70s. And then the voice gets worse and starts saying things like, you're nothing special. That your ex-wife never saw you and no woman ever will because there's nothing to see. And I was feeling really good about myself. And that's when some very, very strange things started to happen. I would be in the produce section of Ralph's, and I'd start to get these nods from across the produce section like that. And I'd be at a Kings game, and somebody would come up and slap me on the back. You're great! You're terrific, man! Or someone would shake my hand. Oh, man, it's so great to meet you. It's so nice. After this happened about 10 times, I figured I was being mistaken for somebody else and just held the hand of the guy who was shaking it. And I said, who do you think I am? And he looks at me like I'm crazy. And he says, aren't you Andy Kindler? Who the fuck is Andy Kindler? I had no idea who Andy Kindler was at all. So I Google, right? And I'm like, all right, there's a resemblance, I guess. Let's see, he's a comedian. Let me show my kids. Kids always tell the truth. Let's show my kids. I show my kids the picture, and they're like, holy shit, Dad, he's exactly like you. And they immediately start crying because they don't want the bad man who looks like me coming around town, you know? But a fantasy kind of pops into my head right then. I'm like, ah, okay, I'm kind of clever here. Let's see, you know, next time this happens, you know, I'll kind of play it along, you know. Maybe I'll get a drink out of it or a laugh or whatever. Or maybe I'll get a woman in the sack, right? Yeah, this could work because I don't have to be me now, right? I can be Andy Kindler. And then I start thinking more, getting even more devious, and I'm thinking, okay, there's plausible deniability here too, right? I mean, as long as she doesn't say Andy or shouts Andy while we're having sex, then after we have sex, if the name comes up, why do you thought it was who? Oh, no, that was your mistake. I'm so sorry, but you had a good time, right? So as fate would have it, as almost as if by design, a few weeks later, I'm in my favorite bar, the most extraordinary woman I had ever seen, even here in L.A. And don't get me wrong, ladies, I love all of you. But she was something else, like a Greek goddess. Like, she had curves that, like, could bend light. It was like God said, I'm going to try designing this one with just a protractor. And it worked. And she comes over to me, and she says, I think you're hilarious. Oh. So we start talking, and it gets better. She owns a smoke shop in town. Good job. Previous job? Working at the Crazy Horse in Las Vegas as a stripper. Okay, the mojo's back, right? I'm having a good time. I'm funny. I'm charming. I'm myself. She is laughing. And when she laughs, she throws her hair back, and it's all cascading like a waterfall all over her shoulders, and I'm smelling that perfume she's wearing, and that perfume, I know that perfume because I fixed the fragrance industry a few years ago, and that perfume is making me fucking crazy, and I met the guy who had actually created that perfume, and I know he designed it to evoke what he said was dreamlike infinity. And I'm feeling the dreamlike infinity. I'm wallowing in the dreamlike infinity now because she's totally into me, or Andy Kindler, or whoever. I don't know. I don't really care at this point because I'm drunk and she's had 6 vodka and Red Bulls. And she says, you look too drunk to drive. Why don't I take you home? Okay. So she takes me home in her blue VW with one of the headlights on her front. Front headlight was flashing. She literally had to kick it for it to flash right on. So we get home, and I kick in the door, and I'm ready to go. And she needs a little more warm-up, a little more Andy Kindler wit. That's fine. I can do that. You know, so we sit down and we talk and she drinks and she drinks and she drinks. And we're having a good time. And as we are there longer and longer, my better nature comes out. I'm not a one-night stand kind of guy. I never have been. And there was this sadness about her, kind of a melancholy that was informing kind of everything about her. And I was trying to kind of change the topic because it was distracting, because I think we were forming some kind of a connection, a real one, and getting to know each other as humans. And I'm trying to dispel this. So I say, so tell me, what was the best part about being a stripper at the Crazy Horse? And she says, the power. And then I say, well, what was the worst part? And she says, the lies. And my conscience getting the better of me. And the inner voice is saying, no, 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 plausible deniability, plausible deniability. It's still here. It's still intact. Don't fuck this up. Do not fuck this up. And I'm about to spill the beans. Look, let's fuck, she says. And off we go to the bedroom. So the sex, right? This is why you're all here. I'm sorry to disappoint you. It was not good. It was not good. She just wasn't all there. She was distracted somehow. I think, of course, it's all me, and so my confidence is melting away like the fucking Nazis in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And the voice inside is saying, she wants Andy Kindler, dumbass. She wants Andy Kindler. Do an Andy Kindler thing. Do an Andy Kindler thing. And I'm thinking, WWAD, WWAD. What would Andy do? What would Andy do? I don't have no fucking idea what Andy would do, because I don't know who he is. Okay, he's a comedian. That's fine. But first rule of impersonation, know who you're impersonating. Okay, so what would Andy Kindler do? I know. He's been working all night. Oh, tell jokes. Tell jokes. Tell jokes during sex. Yes, that's great. Don't ever do that. Don't ever do that. Ever. So now I'm panicking and shit. So, all right, come on. Physical. You know how to do this. You remember. Flipping, flopping, seal, dolphin, whatever. Just imagine like a clown having sex in a minefield. And that's what it's turning into. Everything's blowing up, literally. And we just get to a certain point where we just sort of roll off each other in sad, pathetic... And she goes to sleep, because, you know, 18 shots of vodka will do that to you. And I go to sleep. The next morning, about 7:30, she pops awake. Whoop! Like a jack-in-the-box. Oh, my God. I have to be at court for the custody hearing for my three kids. And she's gone in like 60 seconds. Whoosh, out the door. And I'm thinking, the sex was that bad. She had to come up with that pathetic excuse. I didn't even have to kick her out. And I'm confused. I'm feeling weird. I'm like, I'm trying to go through what the hell happened. So I call an ex-girlfriend, Gabby. She's good because she's good for a laugh. She's supportive and kind and, you know, kind of listens. And, you know, we've been there for each other. And I tell her this story. And she says, asshole, would you think for 5 seconds, Larry, think for 5 seconds, have a little compassion maybe, because that was not a story she made up. I guarantee you she was in court and she was losing her three kids. And you know why? It's because she's an alcoholic and probably a pot addict and God knows what else. And what she was looking for that night was not sex and certainly not you, but some solace and some comfort, because she is losing her kids. And I think about my kids. And I hate it when ex-girlfriends are right. That's why they're ex-girlfriends. And this is hanging with me for several days. A few days later, I'm binge-watching Lost. And the finale... spoilers. It's like where they all end up like going to heaven or what. I still don't know what the fuck happened. But I do know that John Locke, who was my favorite character, who had been suffering, you know, for the whole fucking show, at the end gets up out of his wheelchair and walks. And I start crying. I start bawling. Actually, I start sobbing. It's the kind of sobs when you know something has shattered and something had shattered inside. And what it was the lock to the vault inside of me, the vault door that I, at that moment, had opened and looked inside and found this empty, cold space, and in the far corner, bruised and wounded and confused, was my authentic self. And we kind of looked at each other and realized simultaneously that we had invested 11 fucking years in our marriage, where we invested everything emotionally and spiritually and made ourselves as open as we possibly could with the hope of being seen completely. And after 11 years, it had not happened, which is not her fault. She just was not capable. At the same time, I had solved my problem, the 18-month problem, which was a realization that I had been wearing personas and masks, anything to hide my authentic self from being hurt again. And the women sensed this and knew it. I was not ready, and they knew it. My authentic self and I cried together and mourned. And then he smacked me upside the head and said, "What the fuck? This is what we have to go through to get to this point? We have to go through this set of ridiculous events where some woman mistakes you for Andy Kindler, her being a former stripper at the Crazy Horse, in order for you to come together for that brief moment where you can lift off each other's masks and maybe take a few steps towards being ready. This is what we have to go through to get to this point. I don't want to be one of your clients. Is this what it takes to solve one of their problems? You got to go around the world in 80 days to solve one of these problems? Are you ready? Are you ready now?" "Yeah, I'm ready." "Good boy." Thank you for listening, everybody.
Traveling east, I let my eyes feast on the first of the morning light. From the leaves of the whispering trees creep the lyrics I've yet to write. Though the scenery inanimate and stale, and the sky an inadequate gray, I was off on a daydream with the song that you gave me, and I'm gone, yes I'm gone, gone away.
That is all for this week's episode, folks. This is Sean Russell Jones behind me now. And let me let you know where Risk is happening next. We are in Los Angeles at the Bootleg Theater on March 18th. Sovereign Sire will be there. Brian Babylon will be there. That's going to be an amazing show. On March 18th, we are also in Burlington, Vermont. I'm going to be there. That is a fabulous show. We're working on four phenomenal stories right now for that Burlington show on March 18th. On April 9th, we're back in Brooklyn at the Bell House. Michael Ian Black will be there. Don will be there. There's someone I haven't yet confirmed, but that's going to be a very exciting show. April 22nd, we're back in Los Angeles at the Bootleg. Minneapolis, on April 29th, we are back at Brave New Workshop. The theme that night is action. On May 20th, we're in Denver, we're coming back on May 20th. The theme is irresistible. So Minneapolis on April 29th, Denver on May 20th. pitch us, guys. Go to wrist-show.com/submissions and pitch us for those shows. Now, there's still more, guys. Coming up on June 9th, we're in Portland, Oregon. The theme is hype. On June 10th, we're in Seattle, Washington. The theme is destructive. On June 11th, we're in Vancouver. The theme is monster. Pitch us for those shows. wrist-show.com/submissions. And you might be a part of one of those shows. And don't forget, if you want to work on your storytelling, that's what we do at thestorystudio.org. You can get one-on-one training over Skype with me, or you can download our video courses and learn in your own time at your own pace, or you can hire us to do a workshop for your staff or a creative team of your own at thestorystudio.org. We've got one special workshop coming up in Minneapolis. It's on April 30th. On April 30th in Minneapolis, I will be co-teaching a workshop with the wonderful Amy Salloway, a great storytelling teacher. The two of us will be teaching a one-day storytelling for business workshop. So if you want to work on your skills, how to communicate around the office or in your career, preparing for job interviews, preparing for speeches, preparing just how to pitch someone something over lunch, for example, come to our one-day storytelling for business workshop in Minneapolis on April 30th, taught by me and Amy Salloway. There's always more to find at thestorystudio.org. And of course, you can find the rest of what we do at risk-show.com. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk. So long, leaving, I'm gone. Feel it now, believe it tomorrow. Your song, tip of my tongue, speaks in words and words that I borrow.
Hi, everybody. I did not expect that Lawrence thing to go that way. I did not expect that. And that was a very, very emotional in many, many ways. First of all, I just can't believe that anybody, it sounds so implausible to me. That looking like me, in any format, I don't care if you're a woman with emotional problems, or you're very drunk, you have a wide area of people you're attracted to. I just can't see it. That's not how I saw it when I was single. And when people see me in the airport, I get no sexual vibe when I'm recognized. None at all.